asleep on the other end of the apartment, but still, they were here. Nothing happened, and after a moment, Avery relaxed. "I'm sorry," Atlas began, but Avery just laughed and pulled him onto the bed with her. "It doesn't matter. None of it matters but you." She reached up to kiss him again, but Atlas beat her to it, his kisses burning her skin, obliterating all thought. When Avery woke up, Atlas's sleeping form was curled around hers, his arm over her shoulder and his breath soft in her ear, living proof that it was real, that she hadn't imagined any of it. She lay still for a while, relishing the feel of Atlas so close to her. Then she turned on her side and kissed him. Atlas stirred. "Hey there," he said drowsily, and smiled. "What are you thinking?" Avery asked, because she wasn't sure how to say what she wanted to.
"Right now I'm thinking how nice it is to lie here and hold you," he murmured, reaching an arm around to pull her closer.
She nestled contentedly into him, but a million questions still whirled through her mind. "Atlas," she tried again. "After Eris's party, when we kissed, you didn't even remember."
She looked at him expectantly, but his brow was furrowed. "I didn't remember," he repeated.
"Aves, you were the one who acted like it never happened."
"No,"
she said automatically. "That couldn't be true, could it?"
"You didn't even kiss me back up on the roof," Atlas went on. "It terrified me. Why do you think I ran away so fast?"
"But you were just standing there eating waffles the next morning like it never happened."
"Only because I thought that was what you wanted me to do."
Avery shook her head, but as she played back through the events of that night, she remembered how fragile that kiss had seemed, how she hadn't dared move for fear of breaking the spell and sending Atlas running. Maybe she'd done that anyway.
"I thought you didn't remember, or didn't care," she whispered.
"Of course I remember. How could I forget kissing the girl I love?"
Avery caught her breath. "I love you too," she said, so glad to finally say it aloud.
It was close to dawn. She should get back to her room before her parents woke up. She stole another glance at Atlas, who lay propped on one elbow beneath the rumpled white sheets. He watched the play of emotions across her face, reading her as always.
"You're leaving," he said.
Avery nodded and reluctantly sat up.
But something else was bothering her.
"What about Lita?" she asked.
"Stubbornness, her one flaw," Atlas always said.
He looked away.
"I feel terrible about how I've treated Lita in all this."
"I should feel terrible, too," Avery thought. But even though Lita was her best friend, it was hard right now to think of her as anything but the obstacle that had kept her from Atlas.
"I really didn't mean to lead her on," he added remorsefully, and Avery was reminded of her thoughts about Watt last night.
"Why did you sleep with her, in the Andes?"
"Because I couldn't have you, Aves."
He shook his head.
"I thought being with Lita might keep me from thinking about you all the time. That's why I went away. To escape the way I felt about you. I kept hoping that if I just ran far enough, eventually I'd figure out a way to stop loving you.
I'm glad it didn't work."
"Of course it didn't work," Atlas smiled. "There's no way it ever could."
Watt headed home from the gym Sunday afternoon, taking a large sip of his painkiller protein shake, and winced at the soreness in his shoulders. It had been a particularly rough session with the boxing bot, per his request. He'd hoped that if he punched the bot hard enough, he would forget the sting of Avery's rejection. So far, it hadn't worked. Watt had never answered the flicker Avery sent late last night. It sounded too much like a brush-off. Nadia, when he turned her back on, had suggested that he respond. But Watt was human and irrational, so he'd left it deliberately unanswered despite Nadia's advice, his silence some kind of stupid, prideful statement. He stepped up to the 236th floor observation deck,
full of recycled water fountains and gimmicky ice pop stands and screaming kids. There were more crowds up here than usual. He caught a glimpse of the sky through the floor-to-ceiling windows and saw a roiling mass of storm clouds gathering. "I didn't realize today was a rain day," Watt remarked to Nadia, moving closer. He'd loved rain days ever since he was a kid. The brightly colored dirigibles that rose into the air and released the hydrosulfates, the way moisture gathered around the exploding chemicals in perfectly symmetrical spirals, and then the satisfying hiss as the desired rain began to fall. Humans couldn't control the weather on a global scale, of course, but they'd figured out localized methods of rain induction and prevention almost 50 years ago. Watt wondered what it had been like back when people were at the mercy of the weather, if they, too, thought rain was beautiful, or if they hated it because they couldn't control it. Avery would know, he thought, then felt annoyed with himself for the thought. "You're welcome," Nadia's voice sounded in his ear tenors. "Wait, you're telling me this was you? You needed cheering up," she said simply. "Sometimes I worry that I'm wasting your talents." Watt shook his head, smiling a little. Leave it to Nadia to hack the Metropolitan Weather Bureau just because a 17-year-old kid had gotten rejected by the girl he liked. But he was grateful. "Do you think Avery likes someone else?" he asked Nadia as the first fat raindrops began to clatter against the skylight overhead. The edges of the tower were lined with them, everywhere the building narrowed as the floors went up. "I know she does." "What do you mean, you know?" Watt thought back, confused. "Do you want me to tell you?" Watt hesitated. Part of him was relieved that Avery's rejection hadn't actually been about him, that he hadn't done anything to make her change her mind. But another part was angry with her for even asking him out at all, feeling the way she clearly felt about this other person. Of course Watt wanted to know who it was. If he asked, though, he would be just as bad as Lita, and knowing wouldn't change what had happened. "Thanks," Watt told Nadia, "but I don't want to know." He held firm the rest of the walk home, through when he walked in the front door and Zara and Amir jumped up excitedly begging him to play games. He held firm all through dinner and helping his parents clean up and putting the twins to bed. Yet he couldn't stop thinking about it. Now that he knew that Nadia knew, that the message was literally inside his own brain, it was like an itch he felt desperate to scratch. Finally, Watt's willpower snapped. He retreated into his room and shut the door firmly behind him. "Changed my mind," he said aloud to Nadia. "I want to know." He didn't care that the knowledge wouldn't be helpful, that it would probably just upset him even more. He needed to know whom Avery had chosen over him. "I'm going to play you the room comp audio from Atlas's room," Nadia told him. "This is from last night, after you left their apartment." "Okay." Watt didn't understand where this was going. Maybe Avery had told Atlas who she liked? Watt frowned as he heard Atlas murmuring, and a moment later, a higher-pitched voice whispering. Okay, so he had a girl with him. Lita would want this, he realized. He could charge her a ton of money for it. He opened his mouth to tell Nadia to fast-forward to the part about Avery. Watt's fingers tightened around the edges of his chair. Oh, God. He recognized that girl's voice. And his anger dissolved into a sick nausea as he realized the truth. Rylan. Later that week, Rylan stood in the doorway of Cord's room, steeling herself for what she was about to do. She'd done it once before, she reminded herself. But it had felt different then, back when Cord was just the asshole who'd hit on her after his party, not the boy who'd taken her to Paris and made her laugh, made her happy, despite everything else going on in her life. The boy she was falling for despite all her better judgment. She thought of V and the looming threat of Hirul in jail and shivered with foreboding. She needed to do it now. Cord had just left for school. She'd heard the front door close behind him. and she wanted to get these and offload them before he was home. Moving quickly, decisively, she slipped into the room and grabbed 5 spokes from Cord's hiding place, shoving them in her back jeans pocket. She walked out the door and halfway down the upstairs hallway and ran straight into Cord. "Hey there," he said, grabbing her shoulders to steady her. "Where are you headed in such a hurry?" "I thought you left," she said, then winced. That was an odd thing to say. She couldn't stop thinking about the last time this had happened, when she'd kissed Cord to keep from being caught red-handed. But now he looked so trusting she didn't even need to distract him. "I'm headed back out," he said, and she realized he was wearing jeans and a plain white shirt instead of his school uniform. "You're cutting again," she realized aloud. Cord looked at her closely, and for a single terrifying moment Ryland thought he had somehow figured out about the spokes, but then he nodded as if coming to a decision. "Do you want to come?" he offered. Ryland hesitated. The spokes were burning a hole in her back pocket. "I don't know," she began, and stopped, seeing the imperceptible flash of hurt that crossed Cord's face. "All right," she amended. This was a terrible idea, going out with Cord when she was carrying so many packets. But this place clearly meant something to Cord. "Trust me, you won't regret it," he said mysteriously, and grinned. They deboarded the private copter and stepped out on the lawn of an abandoned-looking house in West Hampton. "What is this?" Ryland asked, her voice hushed, as Cord unlocked the front door. The copter's blades began to whirl, stirring up the grass in slow, concentric circles before it took off again. Ryland inhaled deeply, relishing all the scents of the world outside the tower, soil and smoke and ocean. It was nice to leave sometimes. "My dad owned this place," Cord explained. "I didn't even know about it until after they died. He left it to me in the will." He said it calmly, but Ryland's heart went out to him. "Just you? Not Bryce?" she couldn't help asking. "Yeah, I have no idea why. Maybe he thought I would appreciate it, or that I needed it more for some reason." He paused, the door open, and gave Ryland a searching look. "You're the first person I've ever brought here." "Thank you for sharing it with me," she said quietly. He led her into the house's entry hall, where automatic lights flickered on, revealing a small, cozy living room and stairs leading up to a second floor. For a moment, Ryland wondered if they were here on some kind of romantic getaway, but Cord was already walking through the kitchen and opening another door. "Here it is," he said in the most reverent tone she'd ever heard him use. High-beam lights flared overhead, illuminating a massive garage filled with at least a dozen cars. Ryland walked inside, confused. Cars couldn't be driven within the tower itself, only hovers, which were owned by building services and operated through a central algorithm. Almost no one in the tower owned an actual auto, except a few upper-floor families who kept them suspended in hydraulic garages. Even in the suburbs, Ryland knew, people rarely owned individual cars anymore. It was so much easier to pool money and go in on a shared ownership, or just pay a subscription ride service. One car, out here in the Hamptons, Ryland might understand. But why did Cord have so many cars? Cord grinned, seeing her uncertainty. "Go look closer," he urged. She ran her hands over the surface of the nearest one, sleek and red. Dust motes rose into the air. She realized that the car had a wheel and a brake pedal. And was that an accelerator? "Wait a minute," Ryland said, as understanding dawned on her. "These weren't auto cars."
"Are they?"
"Yeah," Cord said proudly. "They're old, really old. Driver-run pre-auto car models. My dad left them all to me." He looked fondly at the convertible Ryland was circling. "That one is almost 80 years old."
"But where did they all come from?"
"Wasn't this against the law?" "My dad collected them over the years. They're hard to find, mainly because they're illegal to drive, and insanely hard to get running again, Cord said easily. Plus, they drive on fossil fuels, not electricity, and petroleum is expensive.
Why, though?
Ryland said bluntly. Cord looked excited.
You've been in an auto car before, right?
Yeah, when we visited my grandparents in New Jersey when I was little. Ryland remembered how her mom had called the car on the tablet and it appeared moments later, another family crammed inside since they could only afford the share ride option. They'd typed the address into the screen on the car's interior and off they went, driven by the highway system's automated central computer.
Well, this is nothing like those cars with their built-in speed limits. Come on, I'll show you.
Ryland stayed where she was.
You're telling me that you know how to operate that thing?
She asked, dubious. She wasn't sure she wanted to climb into a huge, dangerous piece of machinery with Cord at the controls.
It has safety belts, and yes, I do.
But safety belts hadn't saved the millions of people who died in car accidents every year before driver-run cars were made illegal. She remembered that much from health class.
How did you learn to drive? She asked, stalling.
I had help, and I practiced. Now come on, he teased.
Where's your sense of adventure?
He held the passenger door gallantly open for her. Ryland sighed, mutinous, and took the proffered seat. The spokes dug sharply into her rear, reminding her what she'd done earlier. She fought aside the fresh wave of guilt that rose up at the thought. Cord reached for the handle of the garage door and manually lifted it up, letting the cool afternoon light stream in. Ryland brought her hand over her eyes to shade them. She watched as Cord reviewed the car, checking the tires, lifting the hood, and studying the silver tangle of the engine beneath. His movements were clean and focused, his brows drawn together in concentration. Finally, he slid into the driver's seat and turned the key in the ignition. The engine purred to life. They started down the leaf-strewn residential road, lined with houses that peered out at them with empty eyes, abandoned in the off-season, toward the turnoff to the Long Island Expressway. Ryland marveled at the way Cord's hands moved on the wheel.
"Want me to teach you to drive later?"
he offered with a wink, following her gaze. She shook her head mutely. The highway extended silent in both directions, on the left to Amagansett and the ferry to Montauk, and on the right, back to the city. Ryland could see the tower far off, nothing but a dark haze in the distance. If she hadn't known better, she might have thought it was a storm cloud.
"Here goes," Cord said, and slammed his foot on the accelerator.
The car lurched forward like a living thing, the needle on the speedometer spiking up to 50, then 80, then 90. The entire world seemed to shrink to a silent pinpoint. Ryland lost all sense of time or place. There was nothing but this, the car beneath them and the curve of the road before them, and the rush of her blood pumping hot and fast through her veins. The landscape flashed past, a blur of sky and dark forest punctuated only by the yellow line glowing on the road. The highway curved ahead. Ryland watched as Cord just barely moved the wheel, letting the car turn smoothly along with it. Her whole body thrummed with the energy of the vehicle beneath them. She understood why Cord loved this so much. The wind pulled her hair in a loose tangle around her shoulders. She could feel Cord looking at her, and she wanted to remind him to keep his eyes on the road, but something told her she didn't need to. He let his right hand fall over the middle console, driving only with his left, and Ryland reached for it. Neither of them spoke. Finally, Cord turned onto a small country lane. Ryland was still trembling from the shock and exhilaration of the highway. She saw a sign that said, "No parking," and wanted to make a joke, something about how even though she'd only been in a car once, she knew what parking implied, until she saw the white ribbon of the beach, and everything else fell from her mind.
"Oh!"
she exclaimed, kicking off her shoes to run toward the water. The wind had carved the sand into small scallops, sloping down to the angry gray surf that mirrored the skies overhead.
"I love this,"
she said eagerly as Cord stepped up behind her. She and Lux had only ever been to a beach once, at Coney Island, and it was miserable and crowded. Here she could only see the sky and the sand and cord. Not even the houses that she knew were right there behind the dunes. It felt like they could be anywhere in the world. Thunder broke, and a sudden downpour rained over them. Cord muttered under his breath to his contacts. Almost instantly, a hover cover emerged from where it had been folded in the trunk of the car and floated through the rain toward them. "Want to go back?" he asked over the increasing roar of the storm as they huddled for shelter on the beach beneath the hover cover. It was the size of a very large blanket, printed with cheerful red and white stripes, like the old-fashioned umbrellas Ryland had seen in pics. But unlike umbrellas, which apparently had to be held aloft by anyone who wanted to use them, hover covers were lifted by tiny aerial motors in each corner. It could have been the storm, or that crazy car ride, or the fact that they were so far from everything resembling normal life. But Ryland was done waiting. None of the complications keeping her apart from Cord seemed important anymore, not even the stolen spokes in her back pocket. It all faded to a distant blur, drowned out by the rainstorm and the beat of her heart. She kissed him in answer, pulling him down deliberately onto the cold sand. The rain drummed even harder over their tiny, hover-cover-protected square of beach, but underneath, the sand was still warm. Cord seemed to understand her sense of purpose. He didn't say anything, just kissed her back, slowly, as if they had all the time in the world. Eris stood outside Cascade, an out-of-the-way French restaurant on the 930th floor. She tried pinging her mom one last time, just in case, but Caroline didn't pick up, and she hadn't been at home earlier either. Eris shook her head in irritation and stepped inside. She would just have dinner with Mr. Cole on her own. Ever since their lunch last week, Eris had been asking her mom constant questions. What did it mean that Mr. Cole was her father? When were they going to see him again? "I don't know, Eris. It's only been a few days," Caroline had said, then sighed. "I'll send him a message and we'll see what he says." So Mr. Cole had arranged this dinner. Eris had been looking forward to it all week, had discussed it at length with Mariel, who nodded and listened but didn't seem sure what advice to give. The weirdest part was seeing Lita at school and being unable to say anything. Mr. Cole had asked Eris to let him be the one to tell her, in his own time. Of course, it was his secret to tell. Yet Eris hadn't been able to keep herself from stealing glances at Lita all week, marveling at the fact that they were half-sisters, searching for some common features in their utterly different faces. Perhaps something around the mouths, she'd thought one day during lunch, watching Lita across the table. They both had that deep cupid's bow and a full, sensuous lower lip. Eris had always thought, uncharitably, that a mouth like that was wasted on Lita, who was clearly too uptight to put it to good use. But she'd never noticed how similar it was to her own. "What? Do I have something in my teeth?" Lita had snapped, noticing her staring. Eris rolled her eyes and looked away, as if bored by the question. Now she tossed her hair with the old entitled confidence and nodded at the hostess. "Mr. Cole's party," she murmured, and followed the girl to where her birth father was sitting, at a small round table by the windows. "Eris," Mr. Cole said warmly as she took a seat. "You look lovely." "Thank you." She was wearing a dress of Avery's that she'd borrowed, a navy shift with tiny darts that hugged her figure and flared around her knees. She'd thrown her mom's pearl necklace on over it, and felt almost normal again. "I'm sorry my mom couldn't make it," she began, about to explain that she'd looked for Caroline everywhere, but Mr. Cole shook his head. "I already spoke to her." For a moment his jaw tightened, but then the moment passed and he relaxed into a smile. "So, Eris," he said genially, "I hear I missed your birthday last month." Had it really only been a month since her party at Bubble Lounge, since all the trappings of her former life were finally gone? It seemed like longer. "That's okay," she said. But Mr. Cole was pulling something out of his briefcase, a signature orange Calvador scarf box. Eris held her breath and untied the fat paper ribbon. Propelled by tiny compostable microsensors, it self-folded into an origami butterfly and flew off in search of the nearest recycle bin. Eris gasped. Inside the box was a beautiful, hand-embroidered cashmere scarf, covered in a buckled equestrian print with a scarlet floral border. She'd seen this in the window at Calvador. It was a one-of-a-kind piece and inordinately expensive. Exactly the kind of thing Eris used to buy for herself, back when money was no object.
"This is too much. I can't accept it," she murmured, though of course she had no intention of giving it back.
She buried her face in the cashmere and took a deep breath.
"Consider it 17 years worth of birthday presents from your father," Mr. Cole said gruffly.
Father? Wasn't that the first time he'd used that word in reference to her? Feeling impulsive, Eris stood up and leaned across the small table to kiss him lightly on the cheek, the way she always used to do with the man she'd thought was her dad. Her father seemed a little surprised by the show of affection, but accepted it. Eris wondered if Lita didn't do stuff like that. Oh well, he'd just have to get used to Eris's impulsiveness.
"Thank you," she said, and tied the scarf in a jaunty knot around her neck, letting the distinctive embroidery fall over her back. It was the perfect accessory for her navy dress. The waiter approached and they ordered dinner. The lights overhead dimmed, candelabra on the walls flaming into life.
Eris glanced out the old-fashioned, mullioned windows that overlooked Haxley Park, a small, tucked-away public space with gardens and running fountains. She realized that someone might see them together, here by the windows. Her father, seeming to think the same thing, angled his chair a little closer toward the center of the restaurant.
"So, Eris, tell me about your apartment."
"Our apartment?"
"Where you and your mother are living right now. It's not quite spacious enough for the two of you, is it?"
"It's not huge," Eris admitted.
"What floor is it on?"
"103rd.
He paled at the number.
"Oh, God. I hadn't realized it was that bad."
Eris didn't quite like the distaste in his voice, but let it go.
"Poor Caroline," he said, almost to himself.
Their entrees arrived. Eris's father continued to pepper her with questions about her mom, their life downstairs, her schoolwork, whether she'd heard anything from Everett Radson. Eris answered all his questions, wondering what exactly he was leading up to. Maybe the crazy thought she'd had wasn't so crazy after all. Maybe he really was going to suggest they start spending time together, all of them, as a family. Eris considered the possibility and found that she wasn't completely averse to it, though it would feel weird at first, being publicly and openly related to Lita. But if that was what he was hinting at, he didn't quite say it. Finally, they finished eating, and the waiter came to clear away their plates.
"Thank you," Eris said as her father inclined his head to pick up the check.
She shook the scarf out over her shoulders against the sudden chill.
"I'll make sure my mom comes next time."
Though it had been surprisingly nice having her father to herself all evening.
"Eris," he said gently, "I'm not sure there should be a next time."
"What?"
He looked down at the tablecloth, and there was no mistaking the sudden clouding of his expression.
"I've enjoyed getting to spend time with you recently, Eris. I really have. I'm proud of the beautiful young lady you've grown up to be. You're so like your mother was at your age, you know."
His expression tightened.
"But I'd be lying if I said this news hasn't been a shock to me. And I'm not sure it's wise for us to keep spending time together in public settings."
Eris felt suddenly as if the air was too thick to breathe.
"Why?"
she managed.
"It's delicate, this relationship," Mr. Cole said. "It complicates things for me, for your mother, and for you as well."
"And for your family,"
Eris said, the cold realization washing over her.
"Your wife, Jamie, and Lita."
He blinked a little at that.
"Well, yes," Mr. Cole admitted. I don't want them to find out, for obvious reasons. You understand, of course.
Eris did understand. She and her mom were the dirty little secrets he wanted kept buried.
Now about your finances,
Mr. Cole said, his tone utterly businesslike now.
I've already spoken about this with your mother, though she didn't accurately convey how dire your situation is.
It's not dire, Eris wanted to say, her fierce, stubborn pride kicking in. We're doing okay, given everything.
I'm transferring a lump sum to your account, as well as to your mom's, and I'll pay you both a monthly allowance as well. It's already been deposited, if you'd like to check.
A little shocked, Eris muttered the commands to open up her bank balance, and gasped at the number of zeros that were now lined up there.
Is that enough?
Mr. Cole asked, but of course the question was ridiculous. It was more than enough. To move out of the lower floors, buy a new apartment, replace all her clothes, and then some. It was enough to buy her old life back. Eris knew what he was really asking, whether she understood the unspoken price, that she never tell anyone he was her birth father. Not even Lita, she thought. Or rather, especially not Lita. He was buying her silence. Eris didn't answer right away. She was looking at her father's face, which she'd been studying all week in search of her own features, except this time she was trying to read his emotions. There was resignation there, and a little fear, and also something that might have been affection. She could see herself reflected in his eyes as he looked back at her, unspeaking. Her birth father was disavowing all relation to her. It upset Eris more than she would have guessed. She felt lonely, and rejected, and angry. But emerging the strongest of all her warring emotions was a sense of relief that she wouldn't have to be poor anymore. Never one to linger once her mind was made up, Eris stood abruptly. "It's more than enough," she said. "Thank you for the scarf, and everything else." Mr. Cole nodded, understanding her meaning. "Goodbye, Eris," he said softly. Eris turned and walked out of the restaurant without another word, without even saying farewell to the only father she had left. "Abandoned by two dads," she thought sourly. What a great therapy candidate she was turning out to be. Lita stood outside the gates of Haxley Park on First Avenue, her eyes darting back and forth along the quiet, tree-lined street. She felt shaky and tense all over. It had been Ross's idea to meet here at Haxley, where they always used to do handoffs before Lita's stint in rehab. She took a deep breath and started into the park, the old-fashioned iron gates swinging smoothly inward on automatic sensors. A flood of memories washed over her. One of the first times she took Zenperhydrin, when she'd felt so laser-focused she did all her homework for the rest of the year. The afternoon she'd smoked relaxants and lay here on the grass, looking up at the animated clouds on the ceiling in the hopes of finding a pattern. The time she and Cord took his spokes together and chased a mosquito around for hours until they stumbled back, laughing, to his apartment. And now she was back again. Everyone knew that Haxley was the best upper-floor park for getting high. There were tons of ventilators in its ceiling, since it was in a corner of the tower, where the floor's overall airflow might otherwise slow down. It had no playgrounds, so there were no little kids or nannies around. In fact, it was conveniently empty most of the time, tucked away like this on the eastern side of a floor that was mostly office space. The only part that ever had any people was the section by the windows, where a couple of restaurants, a seafood place, and a French bistro, looked out over the gardens. Sure enough, the park's central pathway was completely empty, even on a Friday evening. "Where the hell are you?" Lita said quietly, sending a flicker to Ross. The tower's internal lights were dimming as the evening got later. A chill lifted the hairs on her arms. The centralized ventilation meant that it was always colder toward the edges of the tower, especially in public places where no one wanted to foot the electric bill. Lita hugged herself, wishing she'd changed after school this afternoon. but she'd come straight from her SAT prep session, not even stopping back at home. She was too eager for a hit. There was a garden up ahead with a fountain, blanketed in four-leaf clovers. Lita didn't see anyone in either direction. She'd wait for Ross there, she decided, her ballet flats crunching on the gravel underfoot. Then she caught sight of a familiar face and stopped in the middle of the path. Her dad was seated at that French restaurant, the one with the heavy glass windows that looked out over the rose garden. Strange, Lita thought. Hadn't she heard her mom say he was working late tonight? Maybe he'd gotten out early, but then, who was he with? Lita stood on tiptoe, craning her neck for a better look. He was with a woman, and she most definitely wasn't Lita's mom. Not a woman, she realized, looking at the slight, pale form. A girl? Hell, she couldn't be much older than Lita. And then the girl tossed her hair, a gorgeous red-gold river, and Lita realized she knew that girl, even if she couldn't see the face. It was unmistakable. What the hell was her dad doing out with Eris? "Lip read," she said, focusing as closely as she could on Eris's mouth, desperate to know what they were saying. A message flashed across her eyes. Read obstructed, shorter distance necessary. In spite of everything, Lita refused to believe the evidence in front of her. Surely there was some other explanation for what she was seeing. Surely her dad wasn't having an affair with Eris. There had to be another reason they were having dinner alone, on a Friday night, in secret. She watched, dumbstruck, as Eris reached across the table to take something from her dad. Eris smiled. And then she stood up and leaned forward and kissed Lita's dad, the curtain of her hair blocking their mouths from Lita's view. Lita watched it all as if it were happening in slow motion. Her feet felt rooted to the ground. She watched as Eris, still smiling, settled a scarf around her shoulders. It was the one Lita had seen in her dad's briefcase, the ridiculously expensive one with scarlet flowers. Lita stumbled forward blindly, wanting to scream or throw up. Now it all made sense. The weird way her father had been acting lately, the secrets he'd been keeping. He was having an affair with Eris Dodd Radson. Or Eris Dodd, or whatever the hell her name was now. Lita? About time, she snapped, hurrying toward Ross. What took you so long? Someone's a little antsy. He was young, with thick auburn hair and a face so beautiful and innocent it might have been surged onto him. His brown eyes were wide, thick-lashed, with the slightly dilated pupils of someone wearing contacts, or someone constantly high. He blinked slowly, as if it were an unthinkable struggle to remain awake. So, he said, I have some bad news. I'm out of Zenperhydrin. What? That was the whole reason Lita was meeting him, to get a pack of Zenperhydrin and take them over and over until her world wasn't ripping apart at the seams. Are you serious? He winced. I'm sorry, I don't... What the hell do you have? Ross opened his bag and began pulling things out one by one. So I've got BFX and some pot shots and relaxants, which honestly you need? I'll take it all. Lita cut him off. She snatched the bag and began pawing through its contents. You know, that's enough drugs for several... I told you I don't care. I need it, okay? She shrieked wildly. Ross didn't say anything. All of it but these, she amended, grabbing the telltale black envelopes and shoving them back toward him. She knew from experience how terrible it was taking bad spokes, and the fact that the prescription label had been tampered with was a sure sign that whoever's those were, Lita didn't want to get in their head. Ross nodded and took the spokes, his eyes still on her. "Why don't you keep one?" he said after a beat. "Free of charge. If it's a bad trip, no skin off your back, right?" It's always the same with you, isn't it?
Lita said, rolling her eyes, remembering when it had just been relaxants that Ross comped her.
"Guess I've graduated to the big leagues," she thought with a dark humor. But she kept the spokes packet. It was too expensive to turn down.
She nodded to pay Ross and made a little motion that could have meant thanks or could have meant leave me alone. Ross shrugged, accepting her payment, and shoved his hands in his pockets before heading out. Lita clutched her red leather satchel tight to her chest, the paper sack of drugs crinkling reassuringly inside. She needed to get high, so high that even the sight of Eris kissing her father was erased brutally from her mind.
Avery. "I'm so happy Mom and Dad are gone," Avery murmured. Her parents were at a wedding in Hawaii this weekend, not returning till Sunday.
"Me too."
Atlas lay stretched out behind her on the couch, one arm curled beneath her. Avery still had on her school uniform, but Atlas wasn't wearing a shirt, and it was distracting her.
"Mainly I'm just happy being with you, Aves," he said,
and kissed her lightly at the base of her neck. Avery shivered. She loved when he touched her like that. She loved when he touched her anyway at all, really, even if it was just brushing her foot under the table, the way he'd done at dinner all week. She knew what Atlas meant. She hadn't even known it was possible to be this happy. It was as if her entire life she'd lived in a world with limits, and then suddenly she'd discovered the way into a vaster, better, brighter world. A message scrolled across her vision.
"What are you up to?"
Eris had written. Avery muttered under her breath, composing a reply. "Sorry, I'm just staying in and watching movies with Atlas."
"Eris," she said by way of explanation, because of course he'd heard her.
Atlas nodded.
"You can invite her over if you want," he said,
but Avery shook her head.
"And make you put on a shirt? I don't think so."
She felt Atlas smile against her hair.
"How's Eris doing with all her family stuff?" he asked. He'd been there, of course, for the whole debacle at Eris's birthday.
"I think she's good, actually," Avery said, which was true. Eris had seemed better these days, her whole demeanor more buoyant.
"She's even starting to see someone down tower. I've been dying to meet her."
"Cord can't be too happy about that,"
Atlas guessed, but Avery shook her head. "Cord was the one who broke up with Eris, I think."
"Really? That must be a first."
Eris was notorious for being the one to end relationships whenever things got complicated. She'd done it to at least two of Atlas's friends last year. Avery flipped onto her other side so that her face was just inches from Atlas's.
"You know, Eris asked me something this week, about why I've been so happy lately."
"Oh yeah? What did you tell her?"
"That I have a new yoga instructor," Avery said with mock seriousness.
"Yoga? Is that my code name?"
Atlas leaned in to kiss her, and Avery pressed her body up against his, kissing him back. They lay there contentedly, their breathing soft and even, neither of them eager to move.
"Atlas," Avery ventured after a while, "when did you know that you loved me?"
"I've always loved you," he said earnestly.
"I mean, when did you truly realize it?"
Atlas shook his head.
"I've known it forever. Why, did you have a moment in mind?"
Avery bit her lip. Now she felt silly for bringing it up, but Atlas was looking at her expectantly.
"It was one day after school. You probably won't even remember," she told him.
"We walked across the street together to the lift line, but then you were going down tower to the hockey rink for practice, and I was heading home. I stood there waiting, and I could see you across the empty elevator shaft. I don't think you looked over at me." She hesitated for a moment, remembering how Atlas had been illuminated from behind, the light streaming out to gild the edges of his form. "For some reason, the thought that we were heading different directions made me sad. I know it sounds stupid," she said, rushing to get the words out. "But looking at you in that moment, I just thought, I never want to be apart from him."
That wasn't what I expected you to say,
Atlas admitted.
Why?
I just thought you'd have some big, dramatic, epic moment.
But I like this better.
She nodded, twining her hand in his. She could feel new calluses on his palm, right at the base of each finger, from all the hard labor he'd done this year. She wanted to kiss them all, one by one.
"Ready to go to sleep?" Atlas asked.
"We haven't finished the movie," Avery protested, though of course they hadn't really been watching. But Atlas didn't argue, knowing what she meant. She didn't want to go to bed because that meant the end of another day, which meant that they were one day closer to the return of reality. It had been so fun recently with their parents gone, playing house, not worrying about being caught. She glanced around at the blissful chaos that had taken over their apartment, discarded plates of food and pillows thrown off the couch, and Atlas's shirt wadded in a corner. Avery knew she was going to miss this when her parents got back. She'd been trying to ignore the reality of their situation, but the ugly truth of it was always there, looming in the corners of her mind. Because no matter what she and Atlas did, their relationship couldn't amount to more than this. Stolen, secret moments whenever they could manage it. They could never have a life together.
"What was your favorite place you went this year?"
She sat up, trying to distract herself from those thoughts. Atlas considered the question.
"I went to so many places, Aves. Pretty much anywhere I knew it would be hard to find me. Cuba, the Arctic, Budapest. I worked on a wilderness lodge in the Amazon and a ranch in New Zealand. I was a bartender in Africa for a while," he added, with a nod to her necklace.
"That sounds lonely," Avery whispered.
"It was. Especially since I was trying to forget about you," Atlas said.
And there was a hurt in his voice she didn't like. She wondered how many girls Atlas had slept with in his quest to forget about her, then ushered that thought swiftly from her mind. It didn't matter. Not anymore.
"But there was one place in particular that I really loved. An island in Indonesia that the rest of the world has pretty much forgotten about. With this insanely white sand and water so clear you can see straight through to the bottom. The town is small, with colored tiled roofs, and they eat nothing but fish and rice and rum. But they're all happy. I worked on a fishing boat there for a while."
"Sounds incredible." Avery smiled at the image of Atlas in rolled-up shirt sleeves and a big floppy hat, hauling fish into a boat in the middle of nowhere. It was a far cry from what he did now, working for their dad.
"It's tech dark," Atlas was saying. "They don't ever have visitors. I had to specially rent a boat just to get there, and it took most of a day."
Avery was gripped by a sudden, wild, wonderful idea.
"What if we went there?"
Atlas looked at her. She forged on, the idea gaining momentum.
"You just said it. They're completely tech dark. No one would ever find us. We could reinvent ourselves, start a new life."
"Avery," he said cautiously, but she didn't care. She could see it now. The little house she and Atlas would live in, with a porch and a hammock for hot summer nights, and steps leading down to the beach where they'd walk hand in hand as the sun set over the water.
"Except
Mom and Dad," she said aloud, and the perfect image wavered a little.
"Exactly," Atlas agreed. "You'd be sad to leave them."
She nodded, her mind still racing over the plan, and realized that something about his wording had been odd.
"We both would."
He seemed reluctant to speak.
"Except they aren't my parents."
"Of course they are!"
"Avery," Atlas said levelly, "I wasn't born to this life the way you were. I was 7 when they brought me up here. I remember what it was like before, how it felt to be hungry and scared, to not know whether you could trust anyone."
"Oh," she breathed, her heart aching. Atlas had never shared any of those memories. Whenever she asked questions about his life before, he would just shut down completely. She'd eventually stopped trying.
Atlas reached for her hands and squeezed them tight, looking straight into her eyes.
This life was never mine to lose. It is yours, though. I want you to think very hard before you say you want to give it all up.
Avery blinked back tears. But there wasn't a question. She would do anything, give up anything, to be with Atlas.
Maybe we can visit them someday, she suggested.
Atlas looked up, realizing the meaning of her words.
You're serious, he said slowly, as if he couldn't quite believe it. You actually want to go?
Yes, Avery whispered, then said it again, louder. Yes, yes, yes! She kissed Atlas over and over, knowing that this was the right decision, the beginning of the rest of her life. Atlas pulled her into a hug and held her close. She stayed there for a while, her head tucked into his shoulder, relishing the feel of him. It was so glorious being able to touch him. She would never take it for granted, she promised herself.
How soon can we go?
She asked when they finally pulled apart. Atlas raised an eyebrow.
How soon do you want to go?
This week?
He laughed, but didn't seem shocked.
Okay, I think I can figure that out.
Tomorrow night let's have a party,
Avery decided impulsively. The moment she said it, she knew it was a fantastic idea. They would bring everyone here and act like it was just a normal Saturday night, but secretly it would be their going-away party. Someday, when she and Atlas lived together on the other side of the world, they would look back and laugh at the memory of this. A silly high school party where everyone else got too drunk, and they stole furtive glances at each other the whole time, wildly in love, and said silent farewells to all their friends.
Really? Atlas said.
Yes! We haven't thrown a party here since before you left. It would be fun hosting it together, like our secret goodbye.
Avery wavered for a moment, realizing that she'd never see Eris again or Leda. But she couldn't think that way. She had to think about her and Atlas, and the fact that they were doing what had always seemed impossible. They were actually building a future together.
Okay. You've convinced me.
Atlas smiled. Avery pulled out her tablet and composed a post, then uploaded it to the feeds.
That's perfect, he said, viewing the message on his contacts as it went live. You're perfect.
He leaned in to kiss her, but Avery pulled back. No one is perfect, least of all me, she countered, a little thrown by the statement. Atlas had always known not to say stuff like that to her. He was the one person she could count on not to.
Sorry, I should have said that you're perfect for me, Atlas amended.
Satisfied, Avery scooted forward to kiss him. She was deeply content in a way she'd never felt before. I'd go anywhere with you, you know, she told him, and Atlas smiled.
Good, he said softly. Let's go everywhere, together.
And then the night really was over, and the holoscreen kept on playing its movie to an audience of none. Leda. Leda stumbled forward and fell to her knees behind the fountain, trying to keep out of sight of the restaurant. Though she wasn't the one who should feel ashamed here. Eris and her father. She briefly considered going home, but she was too desperate and her hands were shaking and she couldn't risk being caught by her mom. Her poor, clueless, cheated-on mom. She fumbled with the bag Ross had given her. The drugs spilled out over the clover in front of her, her own little wellspring of fabricated happiness. Leda's eyes were immediately drawn to the small black spokes envelope. Maybe it wasn't such a bad idea, getting into someone else's head. A screwed-up head, sure, but wasn't her own screwed up anyway? Leda ripped the top of the envelope and popped the bright yellow spokes pill into her mouth, swallowing it dry. There was a brief, uncomfortable moment as her mind instinctively tried to push back. This didn't happen when the spokes were made for you, of course, but there was always a minute of adjustment when you took someone else's spokes, as the needs of their consciousness forced themselves onto your brain. She held her breath,
forcing her mind to quiet, and the spoke slid smoothly over her awareness like a blanket. Everything felt softer, more liquid. Time seemed to stretch like a rubber band. She blinked. Whoever these belonged to, it was clearly someone with anxiety. This was practically a relaxant. She could almost feel the other person, like a ghostly presence, as the drug began to make its way through her brain, searching for memories that weren't there, trying to elicit whatever emotional responses the person had needed. Lita stretched her legs out in front of her and leaned back on her elbows, the rest of the drug still scattered on the clover around her like brightly colored candy. The shadows were increasing, stretching longer over the fountain and across her legs. It wasn't cold out anymore. Eris and her dad, Lita thought again, with a dark, strangled laugh. She closed her eyes. Shadows of memories, half-formed thoughts, crouched hidden in her mind. "I know you," she wanted to say. "But why?" How strange. It felt like deja vu, like this was all a song she'd heard before. Colors and shapes danced across her vision. She recognized this high. She knew it suddenly and instinctively, with a deep animal certainty brought on by the drug, the way she knew that she needed air to breathe. She'd done this before, experienced this particular blend of chemicals and neurostimuli. These were cords, spokes. How strange, she wondered, digging her hands into the four-leaf clovers. She broke a nail. It hurt a little. Why were cords spokes with Ross? Cord wasn't desperate for cash. These were probably stolen. Cord should know. She needed to tell him. Lita floated up to 969 like a balloon. Cord! She was banging on the door. Somehow she'd made it here, though she didn't remember taking an elevator or a hover. Thank God, she thought, because her hands were starting to detach from her body and she was getting worried. She tucked them into her armpits. Cord! She repeated, louder. The door swung open, but it wasn't Cord standing there. It was Bryce. Lita? What's up? Cord's older brother said slowly. He was dressed to go out, in dark wash jeans and a collared shirt that had a lot of buttons undone. He looked so cool. She wished she could be more like him. Lita blinked. She wasn't sure why she was here. Maybe Bryce would know. Are you okay? He asked, his eyes narrowing in concern. She was still standing weirdly, with her hands tucked into her arms. She lowered them self-consciously. It was more important that Bryce like her, even if her hands did float away. "Why don't you come in?" he said, taking her elbow and leading her gently inside. The walls seemed to be rippling toward her like waves in the ocean. Bryce led her to sit on the living room couch, pressing a cold glass of water in her hand. She drained it immediately. He said nothing, just refilled it. She drank the second glass more slowly. "You're high as balls," he said, and she was happy because there was approval, or at least amusement, in his tone. "What did you take?" Lita still had her red bag with her. She pulled out the empty spokes envelope and handed it wordlessly to Bryce. "Cords," she remembered to say. Bryce's eyes narrowed. "You're telling me these are cords? Did he give them to you?" She didn't answer. "Lita Marie Cole!" Bryce said suddenly, reaching forward to grab her shoulders, and something about it, maybe the use of her full name, which she hadn't realized he knew, snapped her back into herself, at least part way. She shook her head. "No," Lita croaked and cleared her throat. "My dealer had them. That's why I wanted to... I mean, I got worried for Cord. They're stolen, right?" She slid both hands under her quads and sat on them to keep from shaking. Comprehension flashed in Bryce's eyes. "Rylan," he said under his breath. "What?" Lita asked. Bryce looked at her through slitted eyes,
then apparently decided that either she was too high to remember or it didn't matter. Our new maid. I think she and Cord have been getting a little close, he explained.